This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Since his first day on the job as New Hampshire Health and Human Services Commissioner, Nick Tumpas has been told to do more with less. Tumpas began his term as commissioner in January 2008, and for the past 4 years, rising caseloads with tighter budgets have been his reality. In response, he's cut staffing by the hundreds, eliminated several regional offices, and reduced programs that serve a wide array of Granite Staters, from the elderly to those with mental illness to vulnerable children. Tumpas has said that while the cuts do create hardship, they also present an opportunity to become more efficient and adopt new models of service delivery. Still, there's no denying the reductions have sparked fear, anger, and even legal action. 10 New Hampshire hospitals have sued the department, arguing that a new method of assessing Medicaid reimbursements amounts to a $250 million loss for them. And the U.S. Justice Department may sue over the state's mental health system, which it describes as broken and in crisis. The department has objected to the substance of both of these critiques, but in general, Commissioner Tumpas has been upfront about the enormous challenges facing his agency. Today in The Exchange, Commissioner Nick Tumpas is here, and let's hear from you. If you work with HHS or receive some of its services, what changes have you noticed in recent years? Do you see more ways for HHS to do more with less, or has it reached the tipping point where that's no longer possible? And given continuing tight budgets, what services should HHS no longer provide that might be provided elsewhere? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address, exchange@nhpr.org. And Commissioner Tumpas, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, you've said for the past couple of years that there will be very real impacts of ever tighter budgets on the people of New Hampshire. So here we are, 4 years into this recession and then slow recovery. What are the impacts? What are you seeing as you look across the state at the people your agency serves?
Right now, we are seeing our caseloads stay right about where they have been. They have not gone down dramatically. They continue to hover at the very highest levels that we've seen over a number of years, creating pressure across the board on the department and on the people that we serve. Exacerbating our problem has been a loss of staff that we had. We are down close to 500 positions, along with keeping from authorized positions that we had a year ago in December. We're down 500 positions, and we have right now almost 200 additional vacancies. So we're trying to operate at a much reduced level. I don't think there's any organization out there that is not dealing with the same thing. Fundamentally, what this does is the budget that was passed last June has challenges across the board. There was not one segment of the populations that we serve that were not impacted. But as you indicated earlier on, this is the reality. I may not like it. Other people may not like it, but it is what the reality is. And so we're trying to look at this and say, is there an opportunity? And in many respects, it's not different from what I've been saying over the past number of years. What is different right now is I think the reality is really settling in for a number of people and saying, now we do need to do some things very, very differently.
Give us some examples, if you could, Commissioner Tumpas, of that impact. I mean, you talk about the department and staff reductions, for example. So on the ground, let's say I need substance abuse treatment, or let's say that I deal with children in foster care. I mean, what am I seeing, feeling every single day now versus perhaps 6 or 7 or 8 years ago?
Well, one of the areas that we've seen, we have a management team that we get together on a biweekly basis for all the program directors. And about a week ago, I went around the horn and just said, tell me what you're seeing right now. And one of the areas, homeless, for example, the shelters, the various shelters that we have across the state are over capacity. They're at 110% capacity, meaning people sleeping on couches and floors and things of that nature.
And that wasn't the case 7, 8 years ago?
No. I mean, this has been something that has been increasing. There were a number of reductions that were made, for example, the Children in Need of Services, where a component of that was covering a large number of kids, and the budget basically said we're only going to limit the services to those that are the deep end kids,
most desperate
kids, the ones that have the severest type of an illness. So the effect on the rest of the kids that we serve, we've made a number of changes out in the community, working more effectively within the community for children, youth, and families, juvenile justice services, and so forth. But so we haven't really seen the huge impact there yet, but we are monitoring it. And that's the thing with a number of the changes that were made, Laura, in the budget, is that it's not like flipping a switch. It is not, unless we're closing down a particular program, which we did in a couple of cases, then the impact is immediate. But with a number of these, you don't know when the impact is really going to impact us.
You know, you've said in our past conversations, Commissioner Tumpas, that, again, although the cuts are painful, it does give you an opportunity to be more efficient, to adopt new models of service delivery, and so forth. I wonder, though, if you keep saying that, does that encourage the legislature to keep cutting your budget? They say, well, look at Nick. He's doing a great job. He's doing more with less. Let's keep whacking away at his budget.
It is a concern that people have raised with me. But we can make ourselves more efficient, and I believe there are efficiencies and ways in which we can be more effective. Use of technologies is going to be one of the areas that's a key theme that we have going forward. But at some point, you reach you talked about a tipping point. You reach a point where, say, we're able to provide these services and be effective. I don't want to try to do everything for everybody and not be very good at it. What we want to try to do is really focus in on those areas that we do believe we can have a positive impact towards helping people make themselves healthier and make themselves more independent. But at some level, the big issue that we're going to have going forward is going to be the aging of the population. That's going to be the piece that is really going to get everybody to really step back and look at it and say, you know, how are we going about doing these things? So that's an area that we know is happening right now, and over the next 5, 10, 15 years is really where it's going to rear its head.
So are we at that tipping point now with HHS, where if you got cut anymore, there's just some serious issues that would come up and you would not be able to serve people who desperately need those services?
Some will argue that we're there right now. Clearly, with a number of the things, the cost and some of the responsibility has got shifted into other areas. It shifts down to the communities. It shifts to the counties. It shifts to the families. So there is all that is going on right now. But, you know, we continue to stay focused on our mission, and I try not to dwell so much on the problem side of it. Say, that's probably one of the most difficult things in terms of this role, is dealing with the today reality at the same time having a vision, having a focus on the future.
So instead of shouting to the rafters, stop cutting, you're trying to find that balance and that positive message. That's difficult.
It is difficult, but the way the process works is that we go through a budget process, and you know, we just went through it. We're talking about dealing with 6 months into the new biennium, and we're internally already starting to talk about developing the budget for the next biennium. So we have our opportunity, and one of the things I feel very good about with my team at the department when we went to the legislature, as difficult a process as it was, we said, if you do this, this is what the impact is going to be. So we were very transparent, very upfront, put that right in
front
of them.
Example, please.
Again, if you cut this particular program for the elderly, congregate housing, for example, congregate housing supports, you're likely to see some people that will start to move into a nursing facility at a more rapid rate than they would have if you kept them in the community.
And then the counties have to pick that up.
Well, the counties have... Yes, but the counties are capped at a certain level.
Let me ask you this too, Commissioner Tumpas, one more question about the budget. And I'm just looking at some numbers that we got from HHS. Now, since 2008, it looks like your budget went up until 2012, and then 2012 and 2013, it goes down. So looking at it overall, it looks like your financing went up over the years.
You've got to remember then in that period of time that you just referenced was the stimulus program, the ARRA, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
So the federal dollars
helped.
So the
federal dollars in terms of the enhanced match for Medicaid, which is the largest program. There were a number of other ARRA funds that came in to be able to provide some support so that we were able to manage through the most difficult period because we were getting that enhanced match from the federal government. That is gone now.
How much were your caseloads going up at that time for either food stamps or Medicaid or housing assistance or whatever?
Since 2009, our caseloads are up 7 or 8% across the board. Some areas much higher than that. But in the food stamp area, for example, is where we really saw a huge increase because that program is directly related to the economy. There are a number of other programs that have our business, if you will, we're countercyclical. So as the economy goes one direction, our operation goes the other.
You said a minute ago, Commissioner Tumpas, that you want to not be everything for everybody and focus on what you can do really well and make a difference in people's lives. So what don't you do? Or what shouldn't you do in that desire not to be everything for everybody?
Well, I think we have to look at we have some techniques and some things that we're looking at right now to look at a process and look at the outcomes that we have. Ultimately, we have to measure what we do or what we don't do based on the type of outcomes that we're going to achieve. And that is, it's easy to say, but to really measure what the impact is going to be in terms of an outcome is supremely difficult. Now, the legislature has put some legislation in that will start having various departments look at performance-based budgeting and talking about outcomes and so forth, which I think is great. We just need to have the resources in order to be able to say, here's what the impact is going to be if we don't do something.
All right. Well, we will talk more after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your questions or comments for Nick Tumpas, Commissioner for New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members. Support also comes to us from the NEEF Network Organizations, the statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. And from Gripponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Gripponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at gripponi.com. More with Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tumpas on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, a call for fairness in the tax code. New Hampshire weather for today, cloudy with some breaks of sunshine, high temperatures from 25 in the North Country, ranging to 40 in southern New Hampshire. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a chance of a few snow showers, lows tonight near 5 above in the North Country, 15 to 20 degrees in the rest of the state. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're sitting down with Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tumpas about how, after repeated budget reductions, his department is adjusting the impact on New Hampshire and ways the commissioner says his department could carry out its services with new models of efficiency. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. If you work with HHS, you're a service provider, or you receive HHS services, what changes have you noticed in recent years? Do you see ways that HHS could do more with less? Or do you think the department has reached the tipping point right now? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Commissioner Tumpas, calls are coming in already. Let's go to Kristen in Concord. Hi, Kristen. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Commissioner Tumpas, my question is in regards to Medicaid managed care in the developmental disability system. And I'm concerned that we have reached the tipping point. And I'd like to hear your opinion on how Medicaid managed care will affect people who receive waivered services from the developmental disability system. And I mean that both in-home supports and for adults who receive services.
Sure. The managed care program If I could just kind of paint a little bit of a bigger picture and then come around to the question that the caller is asking. Managed Medicaid is we're one of the few states that don't do managed care. We use a number of managed care techniques, and managed care is fundamentally changing how we go about paying for and delivering services. And what we want to do is it was the enabling legislation was Senate Bill 147, and we are following through and are tracking to meet the statutory mandates that the legislature set for us. What we plan to do for the roughly 120,000 Medicaid recipients that we have as of the end of December is that we're going to implement managed care in three steps. Step one will be all the populations and all the medical services. So if somebody with a developmental disability, a mental illness, the elderly, and so forth, any of the associated medical services as well as other services that they receive would be put into the managed care program from day one when we go live with it. The waivered services that Kristen is asking about, that will follow a year after we go live. And what we will be doing is we are right now in the process of reaching out to people like Kristen and others to be able to engage them and the families and others to say, what does it look like today? What do we want to do? What type of things do we need to change? One of the key things that we're really trying to do with the managed care is to take a whole person orientation. And right now, our service delivery systems, including DD and others, look at various slices of a person's life. So you've got
The silo approach.
The area agencies do a remarkable job in terms of working with those type of services that Kristen is talking about. But on the medical prescription drugs and other type of support services and so forth, that's not what the focus is. We want to be able to have a real concerted focus so that we're really looking at the individual in a more holistic way and doing that through the managed care program.
Well, Kristen, I'm glad you called because I have a couple questions for you too, Commissioner Tumpas, about Medicaid managed care. First of all, I think when John Stephen ran for governor 2 years ago, he said we could save $300 million by moving to a managed Medicaid model. Is that the savings you're seeing or you hope to achieve?
No. The legislation contemplates a savings of $15 million in the second year of the biennium, $1 million in this year, which is largely the investments that we need in order to be able to make those type of savings. And I'm comfortable in terms of being able to achieve that number, the $300 million. I'm not quite sure where that comes from. That would be basically a 30% plus reduction in the Medicaid program to save $300 million.
Here's an email from Matt, again on this same issue. And Kristen, by the way, thank you for that call. Matt says, I'm concerned about euphemisms that describe painful cuts in terms of becoming more efficient. This efficiency is also financially undercut by many of the supposed cost-saving measures that do not fully take into account safety or quality of life issues. Matt says, this year's transition to managed care seems to me like an approximately 10% cut as money intended for local care of the disabled is shifted to for-profit out-of-state companies. This cut to New Hampshire jobs is of concern, yet the idea of the real-time needs of developmentally disabled individuals being managed by a distant company seems to raise more liability issues than those expressed by the Justice Department for our state's mentally ill. We haven't talked about that yet, but I did want to ask you about that. Matt concludes by saying, other states have tried managed care without achieving projected savings. I'm also concerned that decreasing state contributions to the disabled will result in the loss of federal matching funds. Lots of thoughts there, but pulling out what he says about managed care, he's A, skeptical of the impact, afraid it will hurt people with severe needs, and B, concerned that this is going to be, you know, outsourced to people in Idaho or Illinois or who knows where.
First off, again, to the point that Kristen made, we are not implementing the program for those specific services that he's referring to until the second year of the program. And again, over this next 18 months, we plan to fully engage stakeholders and others on that in order to be able to make sure that their voices are really heard. Secondly, I understand that there's a lot of fear when you talk about managed care. However, I refuse to accept the fact that it's just going to be bad. I've been on this program before. I've heard others talk about the fee-for-service system in the medical way and say that isn't going to work. All right, that's not going to be able to get you the quality. It does not incent physicians and others to pay attention to the primary care. It doesn't emphasize prevention and wellness and so forth. So we've got our priorities mixed up there. So we believe that this program is a way, again, to fundamentally change how things are paid for, what is paid for, and how it is delivered. We want to go into this. We're, quite frankly, my team within the department that has people from the DD, from the mental health and the elderly
DD
services,
is developmentally
disabilities. So we have all those folks fully engaged in the program to be able to make sure that their issues, their concerns are being heard so that as we start negotiating with the various parties that we would work with, that our concerns are being heard. We basically put into the RFP, the request for proposal, that there are a number of positions, a number of functions that we wanted resident here in New Hampshire, not sitting at some other state.
Well, and Matt, thanks for that email. Again, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Our number 1-800-892-6477. Here's another email I want to share with you, Commissioner Tumpas. It's about Medicaid, but on a different subject, which I had wanted to ask you about too. Andrew in Hanover says, New Hampshire already has the lowest Medicaid reimbursement rate in the country. How much lower can it go before Medicaid patients will no longer be able to find providers and hospitals willing to accept Medicaid? Wouldn't such a reimbursement rate violate federal Medicaid law? I wonder about that, too. As the reimbursement rates for doctors get so low, will all of them just decide, look, we're not going to take Medicaid anymore? So you've got coverage in name only. You know, you've got the card, but you can't find a doctor to take you.
Recognizing that, again, today's system is based on a fee-for-service system. So if the whole intent is to say we're going to pay a company a certain amount of dollars per member per month, and then all they're going to do is turn around and go to somebody else and say, and I'm going to try to work your rate down, that's not going to be a successful program as far as I'm concerned. What we are looking at is say, what basis are we using in order to pay? Can we pay on outcomes? Can we pay based on an episode? In other words, the illness. Somebody is a diabetic. We want to pay for a range of different things around that. We want to pay for primary care. We want to pay for prevention and wellness and tie in all that so that, again, so that we're really looking at what we pay for and how we pay for it in a different way as opposed to just saying if it's just a per dip basis, in other words, the fee for service, that there isn't any place left to go in terms of cutting rates. But if you say, I'm going to have a different model for how I, as the state, through the managed care organization, is going to reimburse you for whatever level of service. I think there's an opportunity there in terms of looking at some new models. Clearly,
I
there's
see
a
what
lot,
you're
lot of research that's out there, and a lot of things that we are looking at, and that's what we when we went through the proposal process, and have been talking with the various organizations. There's an opportunity for a lot of innovation to try some new things there.
So you're saying the Medicaid managed care that you talked about may address the concern that Andrew in Hanover has, which is docs just aren't paid enough to see these folks right now.
It will. It must do that.
Let's take some more calls. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Your chance to talk with Nick Tumpas, Commissioner for New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. And Maria is waiting in Wolfboro. Hi, Maria. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I wanted to ask the commissioner about the developmentally disabled wait list. I have a child who is receiving in-home support. The budget has been cut in half in the last couple of years, and it has affected us. But I also know that there are families out there that are really struggling. I know how much it helped our family. I wouldn't be able to work without that program, and it sounds like it's just going to get worse and worse.
And Maria, just remind us, the developmentally disabled waiting list is you get services up until age 21, and then you have to wait, right? Is that how it works, Maria?
Well, I think there are children on the wait list now, not
okay.
Under 21.
All right.
But, I mean, there are different programs. My son's eligible under Katie Beckett, and then he became eligible for in-home supports based on his disability, which is autism. But I know families right in my community that are on the wait list, and they're just desperate.
Okay, Maria, thanks for calling, and good luck with your son. Commissioner Tumpas, this is an issue that always comes up. The wait list, what is it all about? How big is it? And what's the future look like? As you can hear from Maria, yeah, she's worried.
Yeah, I don't have the specific numbers, Laura, in terms of where we stand with the wait list, but we do provide a report to the legislature on a regular basis in terms of where we stand with the wait list and in terms of where the numbers are. In our budget and our request for when we went to the legislature, we asked for the full funding of the wait list. That was cut down in a number of areas. But then at the in the Senate phase of the budget, there were a number of dollars added back in. So I don't know the exact numbers, but it is an issue. There's no question. Again, the demand for services and the need for services across the populations are there. The people meet the criteria, whether it's medical or whether it's financial eligibility. They meet the criteria, and in this particular area, that was instituted a number of years ago in terms of a wait list. The people still get some degree of services, but not the full complement of services that they want. But it is an issue. But I just don't have the specific numbers to tell you where we stand at this particular point in
terms
time.
Of how many people are on it. Right. But can you just step back a minute, Commissioner Tumpas, and what's the wait list about? I mean, so I'm not quite correct to say that you get services as long as you're a child, but once you hit 18 or 21, you have to wait? That's not correct?
When somebody is determined eligible, they're determined eligible, they are to receive services within a certain period of time. I believe it's 90 days they receive to receive the services. If the funds are not available, they go on to a wait list.
And do most states have some sort of a wait list, or are we unique?
That I don't know.
All right. Well, Maria, thank you again for calling. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Commissioner Tumpas, I wanted to ask you about the possibility of a U.S. Justice Department lawsuit over our mental health system, which the department called broken and in crisis. First of all, a couple questions. How do you feel about that characterization, that the mental health system is broken?
This is an interesting topic for me, and we as a department, I've been on this program where we've talked about services for the mentally ill. It has ramifications across the state. But back in 2007, when I first assumed the responsibility as the commissioner, we kicked off a review, and a little bothersome when I read some of the things that were coming back from the Department of Justice is they were taking the document that we produced that said we have a problem. I'm a business guy. The first thing you have to do is say, what's the problem? Put some boundaries around it, and then say, now what are we going to do in order to deal with it? It didn't happen overnight, so we put together a plan that says there needs to be a 10-year plan in order to do that. And that is what it is that we put together back in 2007, 2008 period, and we have been working that. Are there issues? Yes. I would not be not be correct to say, no, that there aren't any issues. The thing is that we have been working against that particular plan that looks at providing assertive community treatment teams, for example, in order to prevent people from ending up in an ER, an emergency room, within a community, to be able to get some additional housing. That's one of the most challenging issues that we have, is to be able to have the appropriate level of supportive housing for them, as well as a range of other type of capabilities that we look at it, and these are in balance. And so we believe that we put together that plan, and we've been working against that plan with the resources. We talked about the fact that we do have fewer resources. That is true. But we've also looked at this as a way in which to be able to redirect some of the dollars. We closed a wing in the at the state hospital and basically redirect some of the dollars out into the community in order to be able to create these treatment teams, as well as to be able to try to find some other services. So I believe we have been doing a pretty fair job given what the resources that we have in order to be able to work this. And it was troubling to see the very words that we had put down to say we acknowledge that we have a problem and that we're working it, and we put together a plan in order to be able to work it. And they said,
aha, you have a problem and we might sue you.
Well,
so
yeah.
They kind of jumped on. You said you did a review of the mental health system. You said, yes, indeed, we have problems. Here's our plan to tackle those problems as best we can. And then Justice down in D.C. jumped on it and said, hey, you've got a problem. We're going to sue you, or we might sue you. Here's a question for you, though. The Concord Monitor had an editorial about this. They said that the state deserves this lawsuit. They said the state only moves forward at the point of a stick. So could this lawsuit, Commissioner Tumpas, from the perspective of the mental health community and people who want to see that mental health system bolstered, could it be a blessing in disguise?
I'm part of the executive branch. I go through a process every 2 years in order to be able to argue for what I have for a budget. You have the numbers there in terms of the budget that we have right now in general funds for the current fiscal year is about $650 million. So that's a lot of money, but that's general funds. We asked for well over $900 million. When we initially went to the legislature to say this is what we're going to need for the operation. So I have my opportunity, and then there's that six-step process that we go through that is the New Hampshire budget. So I have my opportunity to be able to do that. It's the policymakers, and they give me something to work with, and that's what I'm trying to do and to try to use those dollars as best as I can. I'm not in the advocacy business. You give me something, I'm going to work it. I'm going to try to. It may not be enough, but it's still a lot of money, and that's what we need to start. We need to focus in on that.
We'll take more of your calls for Commissioner Tumpas after a short break, and your emails as well. Exchange@nhpr.org is the address. The number 1-800-892-6477, and we'll be right back.
By now, you know you can donate your old car to NHPR. And you know how easy we make it by filling out the paperwork for you, picking up the car, and auctioning it off. But what you may not realize is that we accept more than just cars. You can donate anything to our vehicle donation program, from a snowmobile to an RV to a boat. Find out more at nhpr.org or give us a call and get the process started at 1-877-393-NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Integrated Solar, providing solar electricity, geothermal, and solar hot water to southern New Hampshire and Vermont since 1975. Information at isasolar.com. And the Woodlands at Harvest Hill, a community for independent senior living with on-site nursing available, minutes from Dartmouth College. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we revisit the debate over voter ID laws. Email us your thoughts on voter ID laws before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And then join us tomorrow morning, live at 9 for that. Today, we're sitting down with Commissioner Nick Tumpas to discuss the challenges facing his department, the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Given budget pressures that we've talked about that continue this year, what services do you think HHS might no longer provide that perhaps could be provided elsewhere? Do you see ways for HHS to do more with less, or do you think the department has reached the tipping point? Also, if you have personal experience with the department, you either receive services from it or you work as a service provider, what changes have you noticed in recent years? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. And Commissioner Tumpas, right back to our callers. Vera's waiting in Rochester. Hi, Vera. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. I'm a licensed foster mom out of the Rochester District Office. And I basically take the older kids, mainly boys, because they have a harder time finding placements after they've been in trouble to find a house, a home. Most foster kids end up on the street. You know, the foster kids who go through the system and age out don't do well. And yet the adoption subsidy that was making it possible for people like me to keep these older kids in our homes and our hearts has been cut completely. So when I get a kid at 16 who doesn't have a driver's license, I can't adopt him at that age because I can't afford to insure him $250 a month extra.
Wow.
To add, you know, to add him to my insurance policy. If he has a driver's license, I have to pay the additional. When they eliminated the adoption policy, they virtually guaranteed that these children will not be adopted. And I think that's a crime because I've seen two or three kids who would have done really well if they had some kind of permanency other than you'll be in foster care if you're 18 and then you're on the street.
Vera, first of all, I want to thank you for your service to the state because that is doing work that is very difficult. And good for you for opening up your home to those kids. So I just want to thank her for that. But
absolutely.
To her point, please, Commissioner.
The adoption subsidy, there's so many different aspects to the budget, but I believe what we did, or the legislature really made a change and eliminated that adoption subsidy for new kids. Essentially, the caller is correct, but what we are trying to do is, again, work with people in the community. There really isn't an easy answer to this. What we have tried to do internally, again, in line with trying to be more efficient, is that we melded our juvenile justice and children, youth, and families groups so that now we have a concerted management focus that deals with kids in the child welfare as well as in the juvenile justice area.
Well, Vera, good luck to you, and thanks for calling in. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And calling in from the Seacoast is Guy. Hello, Guy. You're on the air. Welcome.
How are you?
Fine.
Thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a comment and a question, as I think that you, he's doing a great job with the welfare system, although I've been following it pretty closely. I think one of the problems that we have here is that we see a huge welfare fraud in the system in the state of New Hampshire, and quite closely we've seen a lot of that in for an example, in the Gaza Meadows and the Portsmouth area, we've seen over 47 cases in 1 year alone in the Portsmouth of welfare fraud. Out-of-state residents living there, making over $50,000, $60,000 a year in other states and coming over and living in welfare public housing, claiming welfare. And I don't think people, as long as they work and have any laws or any, you know, perhaps stipulations are given to people that need it. But the biggest problems that have arisen is that there's so much welfare fraud going on that people that really need it can't get it, and then the people that don't need it are getting abundance of it. And I'm just wondering, my question is that how much investigation is being taken place with these situations, because there is an enormous amount of this going on.
Okay, Guy, thanks a lot for calling in. Is there, Commissioner Tumpas?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would agree with the caller to say that there's an enormous problem on this, because we have a pretty aggressive and comprehensive fraud and control. Basically, what we are doing right now with areas where there is it's on welfare, food stamps, or some of that. The relatively small dollars that we put on a per case basis. What we try to do is really put our emphasis up front in terms of a front end fraud detection, so that we're looking for any anomalies. We train our staff so that if they see anything, he may well be referring to local welfare. That's something I can't really
speak to.
Town
welfare system.
Yeah, town welfare. But I feel that we have a pretty comprehensive program. We're constantly, we're indeed right now looking at procuring some additional databases so we can do some matches across across state lines to be able to look and see, is somebody receiving unemployment, for example, from someplace else, so that we're pretty aggressive at that. But it no matter where I go, people bring up this issue because it.
It's a fairness issue.
It is a fairness issue.
And he raises a good point that, if there is fraud going on, then the folks who really do truly need it are being cheated of.
Absolutely. So we take this very seriously. But again, for a lot of this is really putting the emphasis up front in terms of rather than trying to chase it, because once somebody has got those particular dollars and so forth, we're not going to be able to recover those for the most part. So what we really try to do is put the emphasis up front to start looking at pattern matching, to really get our frontline staff who do a remarkable job to be able to get them to say something doesn't add up here.
So you have a whole office that looks for
Absolutely.
Cases of cheating. And has that office's staff been cut? You talked earlier about staff reductions.
No, we've actually I can't say specifically if that one has been cut, but a part of it is we're using some newer technologies and accessing databases. We work with the Department of Employment Security, for example, to make sure that we can do matches on their database as well.
Well, and Commissioner Tumpas, we've got just about 10 minutes left, and I really wanted to make sure I covered another lawsuit. The Justice Department may or may not sue. We don't know. But we do know that the state's hospitals have sued, 10 of them, over the way that the state has decided to make a change in its Medicaid reimbursement program. Now, this is incredibly complicated. We're not going to get into all the details here. But basically, the hospitals say, look, for two decades, we had an arrangement with you, the state, and all of a sudden, you pulled back on us, and it's a hit of $250 million. Do they have a point?
In 2009... I believe it was 2009, the regulations changed from the federal government. So that mechanism that was being done that you referred to, Laura, that changed, and the DSH, Disproportionate Share Hospital Program, which was going to reimburse hospitals for a level of uncompensated care. The way this works is that the hospitals are taxed at a 5.5% against their net patient services revenues. These are, as the name implies, that's net of investments or other type of things, but it's strictly related to what their patient services revenues are. They're taxed on that. That's one transaction that generates n number of dollars
for the state.
That comes into the general fund. At the same time, what we do is we get data from the hospitals to say what level of uncompensated care are you providing, and in the past it was we're going to pay this and we're going to get this back. Well, but in 2009, that changed with a new set of rules from the federal government that said you can't have this hold harmless type of an arrangement. So consequently. There are two different transactions. One is what we're going to tax them, and then the other one is what level of uncompensated care. And that's what we did last year. With the legislature, they limited the payments to the for uncompensated care.
So they still took the taxes in, but they limited those payments out that the hospitals
limited
have traditionally
limited
received.
The payments only to the uncompensated care that were provided by the 13 critical access
right,
hospitals.
Right, which is partly why only 10 hospitals have sued, not all of them. But are you saying then, Commissioner Tumpas, that given the changes that happened at the federal level, the hospitals should not have been surprised? Because I think they felt blindsided by this. Like, whoa, we've always gotten this money and all of a sudden we're not getting it anymore.
Well, again, I'm a little on thin ice here in terms of talking about this given the action. But I will say, when that rule change came about, we brought every hospital CEO into the office and said, "The rules of the game have changed. This is the arrangement that we need to do." We went through that, and there are the process that we use in terms of the budget and so forth. Everything is out there and so forth. So there, I can't speak to what the result and so forth in terms of the impact, but we told the legislature, saying if you do this, there's going to be an impact here.
So, and I know this is in court, so it's touchy. And I can see that you're uncomfortable, but I have to ask you one last question. Hospitals, as you know, Commissioner Tumpas, have reacted by cutting staff, closing down programs, and so forth. You and others have said, look, they don't have to take that route to react to these cuts. They say, yes, we do. What else would you expect us to do given the amount of the cut? What do you think?
If I'm a business and I've got first off, Medicaid is somewhere around 10% of their entire revenues into the hospital system, and
so 10%. This makes up 10% of their
roughly 10
income.
It's some a little bit less, some a little bit more, but roughly 10% of the hospital's income is funded by Medicaid, so what they when they're doing when they're looking at trying to respond to this area as a business, and they are multi-million-dollar businesses, I think they have a range of different things that they can do short of just turning around and saying I'm gonna lay people off. Now we've laid people off. There's a number of people have done that, but I think there are just a range of other type of things that could be done by looking at other
areas of their budget besides staffing.
Looking at other areas. I mean, we had in the discussion it's out there in public and so forth. But we had one hospital say during the hearings that one of the measures that they were going to use in order to be able to cut their spending was to reduce executive bonuses. I have difficulty with that. Not cutting the bonuses, the fact that there are even bonuses there to begin with.
I want to ask you about one more thing happening at the State House, and that's a bill to be heard next week. This would waive the usual certificate of need process that applies to new health care facilities. Some lawmakers want to waive that process for a new Cancer Treatment Centers of America facility that we built in southern New Hampshire. 500 jobs, better cancer care. This is what supporters say. Tax revenue to the community and so forth. How do you feel about the possibility of the certificate of need process being circumvented? And if you could also just super briefly explain what that is.
The certificate of need process is as the name implies, there's a group that will take a look at any new construction that needs to be done for hospitals and the equipment.
Do we really need this?
Do we
really
need this? And so they will look at that. So by saying it doesn't have to go through the certificate of need. Basically, it eliminates a level of oversight. I don't know a whole lot about this. I mean, I have met with the organization when they came in to the state back last year, and asked us a number of questions regarding this as well as other dimensions on this. But everybody else goes through this. There isn't every one of the other hospitals needs to go through this process. It is a legislative issue, and nobody's asked me about it until you just did. But
well, there you have it. Well, I'm going to ask you about another bill before the legislature, and there's a lot. So it's a lot to keep up on. But this one would establish, Commissioner Tumpas, a Made in New Hampshire brand for foods grown or produced in the state, and those foods would be subject only to state food safety laws, exempt from federal. The concern has been that small New Hampshire producers are going to feel the brunt of new federal regulation. Federal regulations that expand the FDA's power to inspect. So, first of all, I'm not sure. I have read that this comes under your jurisdiction, but I'm wondering where the State Agriculture Department comes in. And secondly, I'm just wondering what you think of this, exempting small New Hampshire producers from federal food safety laws.
I believe it is an agriculture a bill, but we do inspections, and as core to our public health mission is really around protecting the health and safety of the population, and so
food outbreaks, for example,
food,
in your
food outbreaks, and I think there's a number of producers, both large and small, who have really effectively branded, Made in New Hampshire, that really locally grown, high quality, and so forth, and so I think what we need to do is take a look and say, cost benefit, if you will, and being able to take a look at this and not just trying to strike a balance between, yes, you have a number of these farms, many of them small micro farms that want to be able to sell the products that they produce on their farms through a farm stand or something like that. So those are things I think we can work with, but you need to try to strike a balance as opposed to just basically saying across the board.
One last question for you. It's a more personal question. Commissioner Tumpas, you just got reappointed for another 4 years in December, right?
Yes, I did.
And was this a hard decision given the troubles of the first 4 years? I mean, you're signing on for a second.
I just felt very strongly that I'm really wedded to the mission of the department. I think we try to do a marvelous job. And with all the different changes, all the different things that we have going on, I had asked the governor to consider me as to take on the role for another 4 years. He said yes. I'm pleased that the executive council saw it the same way, and I look forward to being able to serve the state, the people, and the department over the next 4 years.
Well, I guess we'll talk to you again then. Thank you very much
for
being
here.
All right, that's Nick Tumpas. He's Commissioner of New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Karen Goll. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.